So if you look back at 2014, the combined economy of the European Union was, I mean, it was significantly larger than Russia's.
Oh, by a massive margin, yeah.
Right. By almost every metric, wealth, population, tech, Europe had the upper hand. Yet just a few years later, European leaders were staring down this really terrifying reality.
Yeah, the realization that they physically could not produce enough basic artillery shells to, sustain a high-intensity conflict on their own continent.
Exactly. And that's what we're getting into today. We're taking a deep dive into how an entire continent basically outsourced its geopolitical survival and then
Yeah.
the frantic multi-trillion-dollar scramble to buy it back.
It really is a massive structural shift in the global balance of power. I mean,
Mm-hmm.
for decades after 1945, the dynamic between the U.S. and Western Europe was just the unquestioned bedrock of global security.
Yeah.
But the historical record from 2015 through 2029, which we're looking at, it documents this period of really uncomfortable strategic uncertainty.
Right. And our primary source for this deep dive today is this fascinating collection of analysis from the dossier Trump 2015-2029.
Specifically, chapters 9 and 10.
Yep, chapters 9 and 10. And the overarching mission here for you listening is to really trace that timeline, right? Like, how did Europe go from taking American military backing as like a permanent law of physics?
Right, it's just an absolute given.
Exactly, to realizing they needed an entirely new geopolitical operating system. And we're going to try to keep this heavy subject, fairly light and accessible as we unpack it.
Yeah, and to really understand the magnitude of that shift, you have to look at the psychological baseline of European leadership prior to 2015.
Okay, set the stage for us.
So, generations of policymakers grew up entirely under this American security umbrella, right? The presence of U.S. military power, the deep economic integration, it all just became part of the geopolitical
Or
furniture.
furniture, I like that. You don't even notice it's there anymore.
Exactly. And when a system works that well for that long, the natural political instinct is to focus your resources elsewhere, primarily on domestic social programs, internal economic integration, things like that.
Okay, let's unpack this because I always think of it like living in a house with this massive load-bearing pillar right in the middle of your living room.
Okay, yeah.
And you've lived there so long, you completely forget it's holding the roof up, right? Until a new contractor walks in and goes, hey, why aren't you paying for the upkeep on this pillar?
That's a perfect analogy for the political shockwave documented in the dossier. Because around 2015, the political rhetoric really shifted.
Right. It brought this concept that had mostly been debated in like quiet defense seminars right out onto the main stage.
Yeah, the 2% defense spending
The
metric.
famous 2%. And just to be clear, we are looking purely at the geopolitical impacts here, just impartially reporting what's in the dossier regarding Donald Trump's campaign and presidency.
Right, absolutely. And the critique leveled at Europe during that time basically boiled down to an imbalance of burden.
Which was what exactly?
The argument was that European allies had spent decades benefiting from American protection, right, which allowed them to underinvest in their own military
Oh,
capabilities.
sure. So they had all this extra cash for other things.
Exactly. While the US absorbed the immense financial and strategic costs of global security, so the 2% threshold, meaning member nations should spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense, that became the focal point of all this tension.
And what really stands out in the historical data is just the mechanics of why that 2% target was so routinely ignored by Europe for so long.
Yeah, the domestic politics of it.
Exactly. Because in parliamentary systems, re-election campaigns are rarely won by promising to buy more tanks,
Yeah,
right?
naturally not.
Unless there's this immediate, highly visible threat diverting billions of euros away from healthcare, trains into defense procurement is essentially political poison.
Right. So for years, the numbers just lagged. But, and this is a fascinating paradox from the source, the intense, highly public pressure applied by the U.S. administration actually altered that political calculus entirely.
Right, because critics at the time were terrified this rhetoric would destroy trust in NATO, right?
Exactly. But the actual mechanical outcome was a historic catalyst. The looming anxiety that the U.S. might actually pivot away or, put conditions on its support forced European governments to do something they hadn't done since the Cold War.
They opened their checkbooks.
They really did. The numbers show a massive spike in defense allocations across the continent.
That's classic forcing function. But I mean, throwing money at a defense budget in a boardroom is very different from actually having physical military power.
Oh, completely different.
And that theoretical debate abruptly slammed into physical reality in 2022.
Right. The Russian invasion of Ukraine was the ultimate accelerator here.
Yeah.
It took all those abstract boardroom debates about deterrence and transformed them into immediate existential priorities overnight. It proved that large-scale mechanized warfare just wasn't a relic of the 20th century.
Oh, wait, let me just jump in here on behalf of the listener, because looking at the defense data from the 2010s, France, Germany, the UK, they did have massive defense conglomerates, didn't
He
they?
did, yeah.
Like you've got companies like Rheinmetall, Thales, BAE Systems. These are, titans of military engineering.
Yeah.
So how does the math work there? Why was the outbreak of war in Ukraine treated like this unprecedented, frantic wake-up call for Europe?
Well, were they just building the wrong things?
Kind of, yeah. They were building highly advanced systems, but
Yeah.
for a completely different paradigm of conflict.
Okay, how so?
Think of defense manufacturing like commercial agriculture.
Okay.
If you spend 20 years only planting a highly specialized, cash crap, let's say lightweight, highly mobile gear for counterterrorism operations.
Right, like we saw in the Middle East.
Exactly. If you only do that, you deplete the specific industrial nutrients needed to grow massive fields of staple crops, which in this context means conventional artillery, heavy armor, and just millions of rounds of ammunition.
Ah, I see. It's the hollowing out of the industrial base.
Yes, you can't just flip a switch and ask a factory to suddenly produce 1,155 millimeter artillery shells.
Because the bottleneck isn't usually just like the steel casing, right?
No, it's the specialized metallurgy for the barrels. It's the highly specific chemical compounds for the explosives, like nitrocellulose.
And crucially, the dossier points out it's the human capital and the contract structure, too.
Oh, right. Because defense manufacturing requires constant funding to survive.
Exactly. If governments aren't placing continuous 10-year orders for munitions, those specialized factories simply go bankrupt. The assembly lines get dismantled, and those skilled engineers they move to other industries.
So when the crisis in Ukraine hit, Europe realized their military-industrial complex was sophisticated, but it had zero depth.
Zero depth. They completely lacked the warm production lines necessary to sustain a prolonged conflict.
Which initiated that frantic scramble we mentioned,
Yeah.
injecting massive capital into drone tech, building continent-wide air defense networks, physically expanding manufacturing plants.
Yeah. But this wasn't just about buying more hardware. This realization that they could no longer just outsource their ultimate security triggered a profound psychological shift in Europe.
So what does this all mean? Is Europe essentially, filing for divorce from the US?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it introduces this defining geopolitical doctrine of the era, strategic autonomy.
Strategic autonomy.
Right. And it's not a divorce. It's not a replacement for NATO. It's Europe realizing they needed the sovereign capacity to act independently if American support ever became limited due to, say, shifting domestic priorities in Washington.
I always look at strategic autonomy like a massive tech stack migration.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, for 70 years, Europe basically ran its geopolitical security on a monolithic corporate server hosted by the United States.
Okay, yeah.
It was incredibly reliable, but it was a single point of failure. If that US server went down, or if the admins in Washington decided to prioritize the Indo-Pacific instead, Europe's entire system goes offline.
That's a great way to look at it.
Right. So strategic autonomy is Europe attempting to build a decentralized cloud network. They still want to plug into the US server, but they need their own localized nodes to make sure they stay online no matter what.
That is an incredibly apt way to visualize it. And much like a complex tech migration, it extends way beyond just the military.
Yeah.
The dossier really highlights how this broadened into a comprehensive geopolitical identity.
Because you can't be autonomous if someone else controls your lights. It's
Exactly. You are not strategically autonomous if a foreign adversary can simply turn off your power grid.
Or if you can't manufacture the hardware your society actually runs on,
Yeah.
which explains the intense pivot towards supply chain sovereignty we saw in The Source.
Right, like the push for European semiconductor manufacturing. It wasn't about making cheaper smartphones, modern missile guidance systems, radar arrays, critical civilian infrastructure. They all rely on those chips.
And energy security underwent the same kind of revolution. They had to aggressively decouple from authoritarian energy suppliers and fundamentally rethink their baseline power sources.
And this evolution of Europe from being primarily just an economic trading bloc into a real hard power geopolitical actor, it sent immediate ripples through the international system.
I bet. What was the reaction in Washington like?
Well, it was fascinating because it was so divided. You had one camp of U.S. policymakers who were absolutely thrilled.
Because Europe was finally doing what they asked.
Yes. This is exactly what they had been demanding for decades. Europe taking responsibility for its own backyard, freeing up American resources for other theaters.
Right, but what about the other camp?
The other camp was deeply anxious about losing influence. If Europe builds its own defense conglomerates, secures its own energy, and doesn't rely on American guarantees, the U.S. loses its most potent lever of influence on the continent.
The dynamic completely shifts from a patron-client relationship to, like, a negotiation between equals.
Exactly. And Washington wasn't the only capital watching this. The dossier notes that nations like China, Russia, India, Turkey, they were all meticulously mapping these shifts.
Right, because if the internal power dynamics of the Western alliance rebalance, it changes the entire global chessboard.
It creates completely new variables. Adversaries can no longer just assume that a provocation in Europe draws an overwhelming American response. But conversely, they now have to deal with a Europe that is significantly more armed and willing to use its own leverage.
Okay, so if Europe is building this decentralized cloud network to replace their reliance on that single U.S. server, they need new, highly reliable nodes, right?
They do. They need partners who can provide what they lack domestically.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because the dossier gives us this sneak peek into Chapter 10, and it moves totally away from traditional European borders.
Yeah, it pivots almost entirely to the north, specifically examining the strategic elevation of Canada.
Canada. It's like realizing your friendly, quiet neighbor is actually a geopolitical heavyweight champion. But, I mean, let's ask the central question posed by the dossier. Can Canada become, for Europe, what the U.S. was after 1945?
The realistic answer the dossier gives is nuanced. Ultimately, no. Canada lacks the massive population, the military size, and the sheer economic dominance of the U.S.
Right. The math just doesn't work to be a superpower replacement.
Exactly. But that's a misframing of what Europe actually requires for strategic autonomy. Europe doesn't need another superpower to hide behind. They need a partner with immense, stable resource depth to fuel their own sovereign capabilities.
And Canada holds a highly specific, incredibly valuable hand of cards there.
Absolutely.
Let's break down those assets, starting with economics. Because they already had the CETA trade agreement integrating their markets, right?
Right. But looking beyond basic trade, the energy demands are just staggering. After the shocks of the 2020s, Europe needed baseload energy from a stable democracy. And Canada's geography has massive natural gas reserves, incredible hydroelectric capacity, and crucially...
uranium.
Yes, uranium. That political stability is the premium Europe is willing to pay for.
But the traditional energy stuff is really just the foundation, isn't it? The true geopolitical leverage is in the materials needed for the green transition and defense tech.
The critical minerals supply chain.
Yes. You can't build a strategically autonomous defense force without lithium, nickel, cobalt, and rare earth elements.
No, you need them for electric vehicle batteries, aerospace components, advanced targeting sensors, everything.
But having the minerals in the ground is only step one.
Right, the extraction. You also need the specialized chemical processing facilities to refine that raw lithium into battery-grade material.
And historically, that processing was concentrated in regions Europe now sees as geopolitical competitors.
Exactly. So partnering with Canada allows Europe to physically relocate those critical supply chains within the borders of a trusted ally. It is the ultimate friendshoring.
Friendshoring, I love that term. But the physical reality of connecting these two partners is honestly the wildest variable in the dossier. We have to talk about the Arctic.
Oh, absolutely. Because as global temperatures rise and the Arctic ice recedes, we are witnessing the opening of a completely new ocean.
And this isn't just about faster Amazon deliveries, right?
Yeah.
The Arctic is becoming a highly contested strategic theater.
Very contested. The Northwest Passage offers a much shorter route between the Atlantic and the Pacific, bypassing choke points like the Panama Canal. But navigating it requires deep water ports, year-round ice-breaking capabilities, and a continuous naval presence.
And if you look at a map, Canada has this massive stretch of that Arctic coastline, which puts them right on the front line of competition with Russia, who has been aggressively expanding its Arctic military footprint in China.
Yeah, China even declared itself a near Arctic state just to justify its presence there.
So for Europe, the math is simple. If your future economic security relies on resources from North America, and those resources are moving through a newly opened, contested ocean scene, you can't just watch from the sidelines.
No, Partnering with Canada gives Europe a legitimate, vital stake in the security architecture of the Northern Hemisphere.
But the dossier emphasizes that this isn't just a transactional business deal, right? A partnership built purely on lithium and shipping lanes is pretty fragile.
Right. The ultimate binding agent here is ideological alignment. We're in a world where assertive authoritarian systems are challenging the rules-based order.
So shared values become a literal strategic asset.
Exactly. Canada and Europe share this deeply ingrained commitment to democratic governance, human rights, and multilateralism. So when supply chains are disrupted, that baseline trust required to share intelligence or integrate military command structures, it already exists.
It just removes the friction. So, summarizing this massive arc we've been on today, the 21st century is really moving away from European dependence on one single superpower and shifting toward a resilient, multipolar network of democratic partners.
That's the big takeaway. The U.S. remains a critical node, but Europe's pursuit of strategic autonomy demands these new partnerships to distribute the load.
Which is inherently messy, right? Mm. Rebuilding industrial bases, rewiring global energy grids, it takes decades. But the alternative is remaining totally vulnerable.
And, you know, just to leave you with a final thought to ponder based on all this.
Yeah, go for it.
Think about those critical minerals in the melting Arctic we just talked about. As Europe and Canada bind their economies tighter together, what happens when those newly opened Arctic shipping routes become the most strategically contested waters on Earth?
Oh, wow.
Right. If Europe is forced to achieve true strategic autonomy to protect that northern lifeline, they will eventually have to project their own modernized naval power into the Arctic alongside Canada.
It won't just look different politically. It will physically function differently.
Exactly. When European fleets are routinely patrolling the Arctic to protect the supply chains fueling their independent tech sectors, the global map will function according to entirely new rules.
It really is a vivid picture of the future. The safety net of the 20th century has definitely shifted, but this whole new complex web of alliances is being forged right now. It's a powerful reminder that in geopolitics, nothing is permanent, and adaptation is basically the only guarantee of survival. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mechanics of global power. And as always, keep analyzing the world around you.